The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host, Dr. Sanford Katz. According to the CDC, vision loss is a serious problem in the U.S. and is expected to increase over the next 30 years due to an increase in the aging population, an increase in chronic diseases, and changing population demographics. In addition, low vision or blindness affects over 3 million Americans. An estimated 11 million people 12 years or older could benefit from refractive vision correction. All of these figures indicate the importance of caring for our eyesight. Here in the studio with me this evening to talk about various conditions that can affect our sight is Dr. Scott Cavanaugh, vitreoretinal surgeon and director of retinal services at the Department of Ophthalmology and assistant professor of ophthalmology at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport. Welcome, Dr. Cavanaugh.
Thank you for having me.
We are also going to be joined shortly by Dr. Chris Shelby, who is an ophthalmologist at the Willis-Knighton Eye Institute. But in the meantime, Dr. Cavanaugh, can you explain for our listeners what kind of training it takes to become an ophthalmologist in general and a vitreoretinal specialist in particular?
The first degree you have to obtain is medical degree. So we start off with 4 years of medical school. That's after college. And for ophthalmology, we have a three-year residency that follows a one-year internship. So it's 4 years of residency. And during that residency, we have medical training, surgical training, training on all the different subjects in ophthalmology, cataract surgery, glaucoma surgery, oculoplastics, and a little bit in retina surgery and retinal procedures.
What distinguishes a ophthalmologist from an optometrist?
Well, in ophthalmology, we start off with a medical degree, an MD, and we specialize in medical treatments of eye diseases, and we go a step further into surgical repair and treatment.
I see. And in optometry, is that a surgical specialty as well?
That's a non-surgical specialty.
It's a non-surgical specialty. Okay.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So, Dr. Cavanaugh, as a retina specialist, what would be the situation by which you might see a patient with a retinal problem? How would that patient get you? First off, how would they know they had a retinal problem? Would they come to you directly, or would they be referred from, let's say, a general ophthalmologist?
I'd say it's about 50-50. Many of my patients are referred because of a known retinal issue found on eye exam at another ophthalmologist's office. And I'd say the other half are patients who we screen and monitor with either diabetes or other health-related issues or vision changes. So it's an equal mix.
I see. And you mentioned diabetes. What are the common conditions for which somebody would see a retina specialist like yourself? Diabetes.
Diabetes is definitely one of them.
Okay, so how does diabetes affect the eyes?
Diabetes affects, of course, the entire body. And it has a big effect on blood vessels. One of the neat things about the retina and about the eye is it's a place where we can see the blood vessels directly. We can look directly at them. And we're able to evaluate the health of blood vessels. And diabetes causes injury to some of the cells of those blood vessels, and it leads to small hemorrhages, leakage of fluid, and swelling of the retina. It can also lead to new blood vessel growth and bleeding inside of the eye. Those are a few of the retinal issues they'll cause. Diabetes can also cause, you know, transient changes in vision due to cataract changes or swelling of the lens in the eye, and just different states of hydration or dehydration inside of the eye can lead to blurry vision that comes and goes. The retinal issues the blurry vision tends to come on and stay until it's treated.
So With diabetes effects to the retina, are those reversible?
A lot of the effects are reversible. For instance, as far as retinal issues go, one of the main issues we have with diabetes is swelling of the retina, swelling of the macula, which is the center of your vision. And macular edema is what it's called. And that's one of the major vision losses with diabetes. That is treatable for the most part, not always easy to get rid of the swelling. But there are a number of medicines we can use that we actually place inside of the eye with injections, so intraocular injections, and also there's a few laser procedures we can use to try to treat the blood vessels that are leaking the most, or the blood vessels that are causing the decrease in vision.
So in a situation like that, potentially the loss of vision can be reversed?
Vision can be improved, yes.
Improved. Okay. And now, we're talking about the retina, but for our listeners, could you explain what the retina does?
The retina is like a wallpaper on the inside of the eye, and it is made up of small nerves and photoreceptors and other cells that take light that enters the eye. Well, light bounces off an object, and the photoreceptors in the retina recognize the shape, the color, the texture of it, and transmit that information to the brain, and able to perceive an image.
Okay. Now, are there other diseases that affect the retina besides diabetes?
There are quite a few. Diabetes is a major issue, but also other vascular problems. Any part of the retina that loses blood flow is problematic. And hypertension can have some changes. You can also develop blood clots inside of the eye and some of the blood vessels. The arteries can have troubles. If there's a cholesterol issue or if there's a cholesterol buildup in the arteries of the neck, then some of those little cholesterol plaques can dislodge and block the arteries and the blood flow through the retina. And that's a serious cause of vision loss. Macular degeneration is another major issue we deal with in our aging population.
What exactly is macular degeneration?
Macular degeneration is, it's a degeneration or decreasing health of the cells under the retina. The cells that take light and turn it into images, those cells over time go through stress and damage, and they're usually able to repair themselves to some degree early on and handle those stresses. Later in life, the ability of those cells to maintain their health is impaired. And with so many of us living longer and longer, we're running into those issues more often.
So is macular degeneration a disease of an elderly population or an older population?
Absolutely. It doesn't really start until after the age of 50 or 55. If there's macular issues prior to that, it's probably from a different cause.
And you'd say that's pretty common?
Macular degeneration?
Yes.
Absolutely, it's very common.
I was reading that affects... macular degeneration affects over 10 million Americans. Would you say that's a reasonable number?
Absolutely. And the number grows, of course, each year. The population growth and the age of the population or the size of the age group that are affected by macular degeneration is growing every year. And so it's an expanding problem.
I'd also read that it's the number one cause of vision loss. Is that true?
It is absolutely the number one cause of vision loss in that population.
Okay. And now, how is the vision loss with macular degeneration different than, let's say, with the vision changes that would occur with diabetic retinopathy?
Well, from a patient standpoint, it actually might be hard to tell the difference early on. There's two forms of macular degeneration. We have a dry form of macular degeneration, that's usually how it starts, is dry macular degeneration, in which there's the health of the cells decline over time, and around the center of the vision, as the health of those cells decline, we lose the cells. In that area, wherever we lose the cells, we lose vision. And it starts off as a graying of the center of vision, or right around the center of vision, a gray tint to images, and it can end up as just a dark spot or an area where you can't see. The second part, or the other type of macular degeneration, is called wet macular degeneration. And that's where once we lose some of those cells, it creates a weak spot in the back of the eye. And blood vessels sometimes take advantage of that. And they grow. They grow through the retina, and they leak, and they bleed, and they cause trouble, and they cause scar tissue. That's what changes it from a dry macular degeneration to a wet macular degeneration. That can be a quite a sudden loss in vision.
So which one's worse?
Oh, they're both bad.
Okay, which one's more common?
Dry macular degeneration is more common, but wet macular degeneration can cause a more abrupt and profound loss of vision in general.
So how do you treat that?
Well, with dry macular degeneration, the treatments are aimed at prevention. No smoking, eating a healthy diet full of leafy green vegetables, and early in the onset of macular degeneration, when I see the early changes, there are vitamins that are designed and studied to help prevent the progression of dry macular degeneration. For wet macular degeneration, we have to actually fight that blood vessel itself. And a few of the medicines that we have now are given as an intraocular injection, and they block the signals that tell the blood vessels to grow. And by doing that, we're able to make those blood vessels regress, go away, and stop leaking or stop bleeding.
So these are injections given directly into the eye.
That's right, directly into the eye.
And my understanding is that these medicines actually got their start as an anti-cancer therapy.
The first medication that we use, bevacizumab, was absolutely a gastrointestinal cancer treatment. And again, it blocks the growth of blood vessels. And it was adapted or tested in the eye, and it worked. Actually, it worked quite well, better than any treatments we had before. Since then, there have been other agents other medications that have been designed specifically for the eye that also work quite well.
Are there any surgical procedures that are employed to treat macular degeneration?
Not as often now. There have been a few surgical procedures that have been tried. Whenever there's a hemorrhage under the retina, or blood under the retina, we know it's going to cause damage. And still occasionally it's done now, where we try to actually go in the eye, remove the blood from under the retina. But we have to do that very carefully, because you can't just drag it out from under the retina. It'll bring all the retinal cells with it. And so we have to use an agent or a medicine injected under the retina, let it break up the blood clot, and then remove it.
And are there any side effects associated with these medicines?
There are side effects. The biggest worry we have when we give an injection inside of the eye is infection. You know, the eye is a closed system. The eye is not exposed to our immune system. It's not exposed to bacteria or infections. And by injecting medication, we create an entry into the eye. Although it seals up quickly, it's a chance for bacteria or infection to get into the eye. So that's the biggest worry. It's very rare, but it can happen.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
I was reading a little bit about implants or telescopic implants placed in the eye for macular degeneration. Is that something that's done commonly, or has it been studied, or what's the
role? I wouldn't
say
it's common. It's one of the options that are somewhat up and coming. And Dr. Shelby will be able to comment a little bit more on that. I believe he's one of the only guys in town that are or around that are implanting those devices. It's aimed at taking the area of useful vision and magnifying it, being better able to use healthy parts of the retina.
Okay. And how about laser therapy? Does that work for macular degeneration?
It does. Laser therapy helps in a couple of ways. When you have a blood vessel growing or leaking or bleeding away from the center of vision, using a laser to stop it before it gets to the center of vision is useful. But once the blood vessel is close to the center of vision, using a laser can actually cause quite a bit of damage there. It leaves behind a scar. And anywhere there's a scar on the retina, there's no vision. So the new medications that we're using now especially for the, for central involving fluid or bleeding, are much better than the laser treatment.
Very good. And what is electroretinography?
That is a way of testing the retinal cells and the retinal fibers and finding out how good are they at transmitting the signal from the photoreceptors, the light as it comes into the eye, all the way back to the brain. You know, how strong is the signal? And it's a good way to evaluate unknown causes of vision loss and to follow patients with that don't have good vision to start with and trying to see, is their disease progressing or is it stable?
I see. So how would somebody even know if they had macular degeneration? I mean, is there something should you have screened versus just getting a pair of readers? How would they know whether to have macular degeneration or if this is or diabetic retinopathy? Do people get routinely evaluated by ophthalmology or should they?
I think everyone should. I think yearly eye exams for everybody is a great idea. As, you know, later in life, as if you feel like you have a visual decline or a change in vision, those things need to be evaluated immediately. Macular degeneration is something that can is a disease that can absolutely sneak up on you, and you won't realize that you're having trouble until the vision loss is there and it's too late to come back from it. That's the worry. And if macular degeneration is found early, we can start vitamins, we can start treatments to help prevent or slow down the progression of it. That's the best way to find it.
Yeah, most patients who are diagnosed with macular degeneration early will see somebody like me who does a lot of cataract surgery, vision exams, things like that. And you know, most vision change, and I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier, but it was like an emergency chalazion. I'm just kidding. That was an inside joke. what will happen is that patients will have this slow, steady change in their vision. So they come and see us. We take a look, and a lot of times it's the normal changes of aging, like cataracts, dry eye, things like that. And then, of course, we do a dilated exam checking for glaucoma, and we look at the retina. And if we see some changes in the retina itself, then we end up referring to the subspecialist like Dr. Cavanaugh, you know, who specializes in just that area. Mm-hmm. And so the key, and what I tell a lot of my patients is, look, you know, all vision change is slow and steady like a glacier. You know, nothing sudden and dramatic. You know, a cataract is nothing you wake up with one day and you can't see. But an acute change like that, like there's a sudden change in vision, there's a sudden blur in the center of your vision, you know, lines become distorted, that's something that needs to be seen right away. We generally see it and then send it over to Dr. Cavanaugh for further evaluation and treatment.
I see. So for the sci-fi fans who might be listening, I have to ask, as a retina specialist, how does a retina scan work? It seems to be like the preferred method of identification in the sci-fi movies now,
that's
and even some of the
questions.
So how exactly does retinal scan work, and is it, you know, is it ready for mainstream identification purposes?
In the early sci-fi movies, and you can see on the advertisement or some of the ads they have for some of the really early movies, where they'd hold an ophthalmoscope and it looked like it shot a laser out of it, you know. That was pretty cool. But the retina scans that we use in evaluating macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy are actually use a light source, and the light is reflected off of the retina, and as it's gathered by the computer as it comes back and judges and actually sees each layer of the retina all the way down through the bottom of the retina. And then that information is transmitted back through a very complicated computerized system that it'd be really hard to describe how that works.
So is everyone's retina have a fingerprint? Is everyone's retina different?
Everybody's retina is different.
So you can use it for identification?
Absolutely.
All right.
For entrance into secret areas and for...
Yeah, correct. Area 51 type of...
Absolutely. Right. Yes, that's a...
Excellent. So, again, I want to remind our listeners, this is a call-in show, and your questions and comments for our guests are welcome. Please call 1-800-552-8502, and we'll get you on the air. So, Dr. Shelby, we were talking before you got in about some diseases that can affect the eye. We talked a little bit about hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes. Are there other... There are other medical conditions in your practice that you see that can affect the eye, let's say, like Sjogren's or arthritis and things of that sort?
Yeah, the most common thing we see that affects vision is birthdays. You know, as people get older, of course, things change. But yes, you know, Sjogren's syndrome, which sounds all fancy, but it's, you know, an autoimmune disease related closely to lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and things like that. And that we'll end up seeing it because the vision change that we see from it is because of dry eye. You know, and what I tell folks is that, you know, if you imagine the eye like a camera at a very basic level, you know, and you have this camera focusing light onto the back. So the front part of the eye, the part I deal with, is like the lens of a camera. The part that Dr. Cavanaugh deals with is like the film of a camera. And so the first layer before you get to the lens is the tear film. And actually, when you look, the most important optical surface is where the air meets the tears. And so a lot of times, especially in women who are getting a little bit older, they begin to notice that the eyes are burning, stinging. You know, they're just getting dry. And so we evaluate that. And dry eye in and of itself is very, very common. Doesn't mean you have Sjogren's or rheumatoid arthritis or something like that. But, you know, that definitely can cause that type of trouble. And so, inflammation. And there's a whole gamut of things that can go on.
And allergies contribute to dry eyes?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And what are some of the causes besides collecting birthdays for the dry eyes? How about medication?
Yeah, antihistamines are the big ones, especially around here, as you can tell. Or those, maybe you can't, you know, I've got some sort of sinus situation going on, but you know, with the allergies, we all take Benadryl or Allegra or Zyrtec or Claritin or whatever, and those in and of themselves will cause an increase in dry eye. Some high blood pressure medications like beta blockers will do it. And, you know, so those are things we review when patients come in. And the thing about your eyes is you should only use your eyes. You shouldn't think about them. You know, so if there's something going on and you're thinking about your eyes, whether it be your vision or your eye burns, it hurts, it blurs, you know, something's going on, that's abnormal. Not necessarily blinding, but that's abnormal, and that's a good reason for us to take a look.
Eye awareness.
That's
awareness.
Right. Yeah.
So,
eye awareness.
So that can be kind of annoying to have chronic dry eyes. And so the treatments, they range from what I imagine from the simple to the more involved. So,
yeah, it's interesting because dry eyes has been around for a long, long time, and it's overdiagnosed and still to this day undertreated because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's some true pathophysiology behind it, meaning that you know, your immune system kicks in. What's called T lymphocytes infiltrate these tear glands, decrease tear film production, and actually turn your tear film from Voss water into like kerosene, you know. And so artificial tears work great in the short term. You know, you feel a burn, sting, you put a drop in, but that's not going to treat the underlying symptoms and so or the cause. So we have drops like Restasis. There's a new drop out now, Xiidra. I don't know, Scott, if you've used that. But it's kind of nice for a little competition because suddenly things get a lot cheaper, you know, a little more readily available. And it's interesting because now we actually do some surgical procedures for certain types of dry eye. You know, fish oil, actually, and for all the supplement folks out there, fish oil and CoQ10 we've seen in our clinic to really help combat the symptoms of dry eye. Coconut oil, believe it or not. Virgin or extra virgin.
In the eye?
Yeah, in the eye. Or along the eyelid margin, because there are certain types of dry eye caused by the lids. And one of my optometrists is from Eastern Europe, and you know, he talks about a lot of these Eastern European and Eastern medicine type of treatments. And when you look, I mean, there's really something to it.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We have a couple callers I want to get to. We have Carolyn from Marshall. Carolyn, welcome to Health Matters.
Fuchs dystrophy.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
I think it's spelled F-U-C-H, Fuchs dystrophy.
Yes, ma'am, Fuchs dystrophy.
Fuchs as in Frank. F as in Frank.
Right, yes, ma'am, F-U-C-H-S.
Right.
Correct.
My mother had that. I didn't know it. And they removed her cataracts, and her cornea never healed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm facing the same situation. I have cataracts, but I'm afraid to have any type of surgery because of my mother's Fuchs dystrophy.
Sure.
They said that's why her cornea didn't heal. It just wouldn't reattach itself. Is there anything that you suggest that I can do to repair my cataract without damaging my cornea permanently?
You know, luckily for us cataract surgeons, the only way to cure a cataract is by surgery. And of course, I say that somewhat jokingly, but, you know, a cataract is a normal change of your God-given lens, and so that's going to happen over time, no matter what you do. Now, Fuchs dystrophy it can be hereditary, but it's actually something that we pick up on exam. And so when a patient's having cataract surgery, you know, one thing we look at is what we call the endothelial cell layer, which is the inside layer to the clear part of your eye. And we can pick up those changes. And honestly, nowadays, because of our technology and we're able to remove cataracts, even very dense ones, with much lower power, the rate of corneal decompensation from Fuchs is very low compared to what it used to be. And and actually, when I see a patient who has Fuchs dystrophy, depending on the severity of it, I'll use certain medications in the operating room to help prevent any more loss of those endothelial cells. And we have great success with it. And listen, on the flip side of that, even in the worst case of Fuchs dystrophy, when you have a cloudy cornea, the surgical options for that now are so much better than they used to be. And it's not near as involved. It's not a full-thickness corneal transplant. We got a couple of guys here in town that do them. It's called a DMEC procedure, and it really is amazing how well the patients do. So anyway, I wouldn't let that hold you back from having cataract surgery.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate your input. Our next caller is Paul from Nacogdoches. Paul? Welcome to Health Matters.
Yes, I'm still here. Thank you guys for having me on. I have two questions. One is, if I'm exercising and then I'm hungry and I eat something like watermelon or a Coke or something right after I exercise, my eyes tend to tear up and I get blurred vision. And I have another question. Are floaters just part of aging? So there's two questions for you.
All right. So floaters, they are to a certain degree part of aging. There's around age 65, I think that around 65% of people will have a degeneration of the gel inside of your eye. Now, that gel inside of your eye is made up of many little fibers, mostly of water, but the fibers and different minerals that maintain a clarity and keep it, you know, keep your vision clear, the center part of your vision clear. Over time, as those fibers, they'll degenerate and break up, and the fluid and the molecules inside of that gel will separate. And some of them will clump together, and some of them will move apart, and early on you can start to see just some small little waves or floaters in your vision. Now, that's the earliest first step of floaters. Later on, that same vitreous gel, which is attached to the retina, can let go. When that lets go, you can have a handful of symptoms. You'll have a new onset of floaters that were probably much more recognizable, and sometimes much more bothersome than before, because you'll see the little fibrous attachments where they stick to the retina. When those let go, you'll see those floating around in the eye. The reason you see them is because they cast shadows onto the retina. And so if you're looking at a background that's bright, like a blue sky, you'll really see those floaters much more often.
I've got about four of those, yeah.
And have you had four for quite a while, the same number you've had?
Yeah, about 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those sound like they're going to be okay. It's the change in the floaters when you go from seeing a couple or a few floaters to all of a sudden you see a handful of floaters or 20 or so floaters. A change is worrisome.
Paul, I have to share with you, about a year or two ago, I started to notice some floaters myself, and it took some getting used to. But every once in a while, I'm convinced that there's a mosquito that's landing on
Absolutely.
Me. And it's flying past my nose and onto my hand, and I swat myself until I realize that that's actually a floater. So,
I've gotten used to them, so I'd probably... not like it if I didn't have them.
There you go.
Well, absolutely. And you get used to them. And a couple of floaters, you normally get to where they don't bother you as much.
Now, if they're bad enough, is there anything that can be done?
There is. We usually, if they're not problematic, your vision is still good, but the floaters are really troubling you, we normally say, let's just deal with it. Let's leave the floaters there. If they get in your way of driving or performing your job or keep you from seeing the things you need to see, well, then there is an option, although we really don't like to take the gel or the floaters out of an eye, especially a healthy eye that otherwise wouldn't have troubles with those floaters.
Now, is it possible that when the vitreous gel pulls away, that you can actually result in a detached retina?
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I understand that's pretty serious.
That is pretty serious. That would, when the gel is letting go of the retina, you know, it's attached to a few areas. It's attached around the nerve in the back of the eye. It's attached around the blood vessels and around the center of your vision. And so as it peels off, if for some reason it's holding on too tight to one area, holding on to the retina too tight, it can pull up and create a tear in the retina. And that's noticed by flashing lights, new onset of floaters. Those are worrisome. If you have a tear in the retina, what that does is it allows an entry of fluid from the gel inside of the eye. It gives it a way to get underneath the retina. And fluid under the retina, that's what a retinal detachment is. And it has to be repaired, or vision loss will get worse and worse until it's not repairable. But if you find it early, if you're having flashes of light and new floaters, we could actually, if we find it early enough, seal off a little area or a tear on the retina before it detaches. But once it's detached, we need to go to the operating room to fix that one.
I see.
And we do laser floaters. As you know, obviously, with Dr. Cavanaugh being a retina specialist, you know, like he was saying, removing that jelly to remove floaters, that's a big surgery for what we consider a minor problem, you know, because a lot of patients who have these floaters are 20/20, you know, and absolutely, we'll say, well, look, just name them, you know, just realize they're going to sit and have lunch and breakfast, dinner with you. And recently we have started to laser some of the more prominent floaters inside the vitreous jelly, and we've had fairly good results with them, you know. And so it's one of those where these patients they're willing to do anything, you know, and they're going to Dr. Cavanaugh's office, browbeating, being like, please do something, you know, I don't care what the risks are. And, you know, it's we can now at least attempt to laser them. And we've had fairly good success. And these are the ones, it's like playing asteroids, you know, as a kid. You know, you see this floater, you zap it, you can break it apart. But the difficult thing for patients to understand is we can't make them go away completely. You know, we can just try to make it to where it's not sitting there when you're reading in the center of your vision.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. So you mentioned the laser. I mean, it seems to me that you hear about these lasers, ophthalmology lasers. There's always a better laser, a new laser coming out, and it's kind of Star Wars. And it seems like their lasers are really being used a lot in the treatment of eye diseases. So you mentioned laser for addressing floaters. What are some of the other settings in which you use lasers in treating people's eyes?
Well, there are a few different types of lasers, and each one of them is used in a different manner. You know, we have photodisruptive lasers, photocoagulative lasers, which actually cause burns, and photoablative lasers used in corrective eye surgery. And so each one of those laser types is used in a different way. Dr. Shelby does a lot of corrective surgery and vision improvement with his lasers.
Right, yeah, and like Dr. Cavanaugh said, a lot of it has to do with the wavelength of light, like the excimer laser, which we use to do LASIK with, and it's considered a cool laser. It's cool as in, hey, well, that's a really neat laser, but actually the wavelength of light it's interesting because you can laser something very fine and thin. It doesn't cause a burn, but it removes the tissue where the laser touches, and that's what allows us to actually do LASIK and reshape the surface of the eye with actually not causing any burns. And then we use what's called a femtosecond laser, which is a very fast firing laser, one quadrillionth of a second, and that allows us to create flaps and make cuts on and around the eye without actually creating a burn or making an incision. You know, and it's the laser technology just keeps getting better and better. And the retina guys, like Dr. Cavanaugh, they've been using lasers for eons, you know, to, like when he was talking about the little retinal tear, they'll use a laser as literally like a spot welder, you know, to reattach or scar down that area of the retina to prevent detachments. We've been using them for glaucoma for a number of years.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
I see. So who is a candidate for these refractive surgery procedures using the laser?
You know, that is a broad question. You know, refractive surgery nowadays is not just limited to people who wear contacts and glasses. You know, it covers anybody with cataracts, everything else, loss of near vision. The newest thing that we have is somebody who, let's say they're 50 years old, they have perfect distance vision, have zero near vision. The old way to do it was either to do LASIK as a monovision, meaning taking the dominant eye, leaving it at a distance, making the non-dominant eye nearsighted, you know, to where you can see at a distance, you can read up close, but you give up a little bit of both and you give up some depth perception. So now we use the femtosecond laser to create a flap on the eye and actually put an implant called a raindrop, which is a 2-millimeter disc we put on the center of the cornea that covers right over the pupil. And what that does is that in ambient lighting, normal lighting conditions, when you're looking off at a distance, both eyes see at a distance. And when you're reading up close, it actually, the pupils get smaller. And so on that non-dominant eye where that raindrop implant is, it allows near vision. It's actually pretty cool.
So that's done instead of the LASIK laser?
Correct. So somebody who's real nearsighted, you know, what we do is they are a candidate for LASIK or some sort of refractive procedure. And we create a flap, raise the flap, and then use that excimer laser to reshape or reduce the focusing power of the cornea. It's very exact, very precise. And we lay that flap down, people can see again. The loss of near vision once you hit 40 has to do with your God-given lens. So the lens inside your eye won't focus up close. And so we have to kind of trick the brain in order to get people out of glasses when they're over the age of 40.
I see. So that's called, is that called presbyopia?
Presbyopia, that's right.
Okay, very good. Now, how does presbyopia, how does that differ from, let's say, myopia or astigmatism? You hear these words. So what do those things mean? Yeah. Myopia or hyperopia? Or
those are just terms for indicating the refractive nature of the eye. So myopia is nearsightedness. And with that, and everybody gets it confused. What's nearsighted? What's farsighted? Nearsighted means you can see up close, you can see it near, you cannot see far away, or your distance vision is blurry. Farsightedness is exactly the opposite, and actually that's what most people are. They're a little bit farsighted to where the distance vision is good, but as we get older, they lose the near vision. So they can see it far away, just can't see up close. Astigmatism is the way the surface of the eye is shaped. And the easiest but somewhat incorrect analogy is the surface of the eye theoretically should be shaped like a basketball, but it's not. You know, they're shaped more like a football. So the cornea is longer in one area than it is another one. And the difference between those two is what we consider astigmatism. And that causes actually a blur in all ranges, near, intermediate, and distance. It actually is one of the most common things to cause a doubling or a shadowed image.
I see. We welcome your phone calls this evening. We're joined this evening by Dr. Chris Shelby from Willis-Knighton Eye Institute, as well as Dr. Scott Cavanaugh, who is a vitreoretinal surgeon and director of retinal services at the Department of Ophthalmology and assistant professor of that department at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So back to the refractive surgery, Dr. Shelby, does it last, or is it, you know, does it last for a long time? Does it last for a short time? Does that depend upon when people get it? How effective is it? And are there side effects?
All things being equal, excuse me, it's incredibly effective. It's very accurate, very predictable, and very stable. And a lot of patients have had the old RK procedures and some of the older stuff. We don't do that anymore because it creates an instability to the eye that causes the vision to change dramatically over time. What I tell patients who are having LASIK, who are nearsighted, and we're doing LASIK on them, there is a half diopter of regression per decade. And what that means is that if you're 30 and we shoot for zero, by the time you're 40, you will be slightly nearsighted. Generally not enough to cause any problems, but there is a little bit of regression. And then 20 years, a little bit more so. Generally, when patients have had LASIK, they're stable enough to where the next time they notice a change in vision is by the time they need cataract surgery. And then, of course, if those that notice it sooner can have enhancements.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Okay. Well, we have a couple calls coming in. Randall from Shreveport. Randall, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I had LASIK eye surgery in 1995, and over the past couple of years, my nearsightedness has returned, and I got in glasses, but I'm also having to use a little bit of reading glasses as well. But it's difficult for me to still read up close in glasses, and I'm wondering if I had a repeat surgery in terms of the LASIK, if that would do anything for my near vision. And I'll hang up and listen on the air. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Okay. It would probably be good to know if he was nearsighted to start with. I assume he was, because he had LASIK at the time.
Yeah, because in 95, that's when it was actually FDA approved in the U.S., unless you were at Emory or one of those institutions. But generally, when you're nearsighted beforehand, you become a little more nearsighted afterwards. And then some of that nearsightedness is what allows you to still read up close. I'm assuming he's over 40. And like we were talking about before, if we go in, enhance somebody who's nearsighted to maximize the distance vision, the near vision gets worse. So what we do is we either do the dominant eye, re-maximize that one for distance, and then we'll take the other eye and actually make that one a little more nearsighted. So like I was saying before, then the brain blends the images from both eyes and then allows near, intermediate, and distance vision.
There are a few people, and this is me from a retina standpoint. There are a certain number of people who are nearsighted or myopic that will have a progression over time of that nearsightedness no matter what you do. And the laser surgery can get you back in focus, get you to 20/20. But over time, if your eye was going to change, become more nearsighted over those years, it won't stop that from happening. The laser surgery won't stop that. Now, that's not a large part of the population, but somebody who has a progressive myopia and become a little more nearsighted every year, there's a chance that that's still going to be an issue after you have it, reset it to zero or get back to 20/20 without glasses. The same progression you would have had before still may happen.
That's true. And then there's a maximum that we can do, based on how much tissue is available and whatnot.
Well, Randall, thank you for your call. I hope that clarified things for you. Our next caller is Carl from Shreveport. Thank you for your call. What's your question?
My question is, I've had a pterygium for quite some time. I had surgery on the first pterygium that I had. Of course, it's the same eye. Probably I had that pterygium for about 15 years, and it wasn't operated on because it wasn't, from what I hear, close enough to the cornea to really create any problems. So when it was close enough, this was about 2 years ago, we went in and they basically cut it out, and in its place they put a graft of amniotic skin cells in that area to keep the pterygium from coming back over. Well, unfortunately, it was pretty aggressive and it came back. And so last year I had a second surgery on the same pterygium. Are there any other options that would help to keep this from becoming a recurring problem?
The biggest issue, Carl, with pterygiums is recurrence across the board. And we, in our practice, we use amniotic membrane graft because in our hands, what we have seen is that our recurrence rate is much lower. But that being said, there's still a percentage of people who have recurrence. And, of course, obviously you fit right there in that category. And there's a million different ways to do it. And we used to use radiation. We used to use mitomycin C. We did autografts where we took a little piece of conjunctiva from the other side of the eye and put it over there. And what we found is that using mitomycin C, removing all of Tenon's capsule, which is kind of it's a layer that's between the conjunctiva and the sclera, and then actually how you put that patch graft is very important too, the recurrence rate is much lower. And all I can tell you is that at this point, obviously there's some scarring going on there. The best way to do it is to repeat the surgery, Or the way I would do it, if you were sitting in front of me, is to repeat the surgery with an extended amount of mitomycin C, along with the repeat of the amniotic graft with a much wider resection. And so, I mean, it's just basically another surgery.
Now, when I was in training as a radiation oncologist, we would occasionally get people referred like with this kind of problem for some very superficial radiation delivered to the eye after surgery to help prevent that pterygium from recurring. And I've done a few of those cases here in Shreveport, but I haven't done many in quite a number of years. Perhaps in the last 8 years, I don't recall seeing one. And maybe it's because things have moved towards mitomycin C and some of the other treatments. But if someone fails the mitomycin C, is there still a role for using radiation after surgery?
Yeah, I don't see why not. Because we used to use that, you know, the localized beta radiation.
Exactly.
And so I could see, especially with how technologically advanced the radiation is now and how localized y'all can get it, how that would probably be very beneficial. Looks like a study.
Looks like a study. thank you, Carl, for your call and for your question. We have a listener who wants to know how LASIK has changed in the past few years. What's new at LASIK?
There's a big answer to that question, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right, really. It's changed a whole lot. You know, when it first came out, it was a little bit of nearsightedness that we could treat, not a whole lot of farsightedness. And the results were very good. And now the spot size of the laser is smaller. So the importance of that is it's like using fine grit sandpaper versus real rough sandpaper, you know, so we can smooth or ablate the tissue much finer, much more accurately. And the range of refractive surgery is much greater. So very nearsighted people. And we can actually treat really farsighted people who have a whole lot of astigmatism. And so the range of patients is much higher. And the flaps that we make are much thinner. And it's a much safer procedure. The way we screen patients is much better, you know, looking for anything that could cause progressive blurred vision over time. So, I mean, from all the way the diagnostics through the therapeutics is much, much better.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
In the time that we have remaining, there are two large topics I wanted to touch on. Dr. Shelby, you did mention cataracts, which I understand is quite common. And then also, we covered macular degeneration, but glaucoma, if we have some time. Dr. Kavanaugh, would you mind just touching on glaucoma and talking a little bit about that?
Well, glaucoma is a disease of the optic nerve. And I feel like we still don't quite understand the fine details of glaucoma. There are things we can control, eye pressure being one of them, or we can try to control. And by lowering the eye pressure, we can slow the progression of the disease. We can lower eye pressure by using medications, eye drops. There are some laser procedures that help to try to open up the natural drainage system of the eye and to lower the pressure. And there are also surgical repairs sometimes needed in order to place an artificial drainage, a tube shunt, or an artificial drain that allows fluid to leave the eye at a lower pressure. So glaucoma is an issue of that also advances as we increase the number of birthdays that we're lucky enough to have. And it can also be a disease that becomes more and more difficult to treat over those same years, and where initially you're able to treat it with just an eye drop or two eye drops, then that number grows to three eye drops, then three eye drops and a laser, and then three eye drops, a laser, and it's still not quite enough. And there are many instances where it ends in surgery. Luckily, surgical treatment for glaucoma, there are quite a few options now. Surgical treatments are pretty effective. And your hopes are you don't have to use the eye drops afterwards. In reality, you still probably need to use. You'll end up using drops at some point.
Yeah, because we and speaking of cataract surgery, you know, the obviously the advancements in cataract surgery come with outcomes in vision. You know, so we try to improve vision as much as we can, getting you back to where you were before you're even in reading glasses. And so the advancements that we have are directed towards that. And but as far as the glaucoma, we at the time of cataract surgery now we put in stents and shunts. That will help reduce pressure in a lot of situations. And so And I saw it early on in practice that taking cataracts off of patients who were on glaucoma drops, especially those that were diagnosed a little bit later in life, simply removing the cataract and putting a new lens in would reduce pressure. And now, you know, about 50% of the time, let's say, across the board in our practice, and now that we have the iStent and the CyPass, where after we've taken the cataract out, put a new lens in, we can put a tiny stent in the drain of the eye. And it's the smallest FDA-approved implant in the world. And what that's done is that's taken our numbers from 50% to about 85%. I mean, it works pretty well. And, you know, it doesn't work in everybody, but at least it's an option to help get the pressure down to where it doesn't cause blindness ultimately.
So you said that you replaced the cataract or the lens with the cataract mm-hmm. with a new lens. So once you do that, does the person no longer need glasses?
Well, it depends on, and it's kind of an a la carte situation. So if somebody came in and said, look, I don't want to be in glasses anymore. I have to wear them when I'm driving. I got to wear them when I'm reading. And based on a number of factors, as long as their eyes are essentially healthy, they don't have something like macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy, then we have a number of options as far as lens implants. So we do cataract surgery generally with the LensX laser to where we make all the incisions, reduce astigmatism. And we have multifocal lenses, which are lenses that when are placed in both eyes, the way they're designed, they provide distance to near vision. You know, realistically, it's a functional range of vision, meaning that, you know, you grab your iPhone, you can read it all the way out to a distance. You know, we can't give you what you have when you're 18, you know, which is from 6 inches on out. You know, we have to give you, you know, something that's more realistic. We have accommodating lenses that actually change shape inside the eye, so they allow a range of vision. So there are a lot of great options out there for patients who, if they want to be out of glasses, as long as their expectations are aligned with reality, you know, they do quite well.
So now if they don't want to, they want to get out of glasses, but they don't want to get into surgery, and they're considering doing, let's say, contact lenses, is that a reasonable alternative? And what are the advantages and disadvantages to doing contact lenses over actually pursuing surgery? Can they get the same kind of vision without having to have surgery?
Well, it would depend. I mean, you know, one of the problems with the cataract is it's blocking the light getting to the retina. And so when we see patients and they're ready for cataract surgery, it's because no matter what we do, glasses, contact lenses, anything like that, we can't get them seeing any better. And at that time, as long as there's nothing else going on with the eye, if it's cataract causing that, then it's either accept the fact that you're blurry or have cataract surgery. Now, after the surgery, you know, if they went with a regular standard lens, which works great, if they ended up with nearsightedness, farsightedness, or astigmatism, they could absolutely wear contacts after that. You know, but like we said earlier, as we get older, the eyes get a little bit drier, they become a little less tolerant of contacts. But yeah, I mean, they can wear glasses, contacts afterwards. We have a number of patients who come in saying, look, I'm just going to wear contacts after cataract surgery. We say that's fine.
Now, what about injuries? Which I just want to touch a little bit upon, like emergencies, ocular emergencies. How do you know when you need to go to the doctor immediately? Let's say
it's usually when I call Dr. Kavanaugh. I'm like, hey, man, what are you doing right now?
If you are weed eating and you feel something hit your eye, go to the doctor.
That's an inside.
Okay. And so, what are some of the symptoms that you know if you know, hey, I need to go right away and get this checked out?
Well, working around, I'm going to give you a few instances because these are quite common. In fact, once a week or so, we have an issue, if not more often than that, with somebody who has an eye injury, whether they knew it at first or not. And we would always much rather see somebody with an eye injury immediately after rather than 2 or 3 days afterwards when it just doesn't get better. And so feeling something hit the eye, I am pretty serious, but weeding is a big issue, or working with power tools, or working with chopping wood, working with a hammer. Any of these things that might have potential to shoot off a piece of metal, kick up a piece of glass, or have a projectile coming towards your eye at a high rate of speed, these things can absolutely enter the eye. You know, sometimes they'll hit the surface of the eye and cause pain, and they'll cause it, you know, a superficial injury that really hurts. At other times, they'll actually make it through the cornea, into the eye, into the center of the eye, but not hurt. Those are the tricky ones, because those are the ones that are infections waiting to happen. And in infections in those situations, we can lose the eye. And so if you feel like something has hit your eye or you feel like something's not right, with no questions about it, go see your eye doctor right then.
And what if it's something more substantial, like not a small foreign body in the eye, but like a large foreign body in the eye? Do you take that out?
No.
You leave it alone?
Leave it alone if you can get to a doctor quickly.
Fish hook.
Yes.
We've seen that.
If you have a fish hook in the eye, leave it there till you get to the doctor. Let him take it out. The reason being, the eye is filled with lots of contents that can't be removed or cause lots of trouble if they are removed, being the retina, the gel in the eye, which can cause lots of trouble if you just try to pull it directly out. The lens in your eye, your iris, all of these things, each one of them are affected by a foreign body entering the eye. And trying to remove it yourself before you get to the eye doctor is never a good option.
You want to just put a plug in for eye protective
gear?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wear eye protection in everything that you do outdoors.
Absolutely. I mean, seriously, if you're around anything that moves more than like 2 RPM, you need to wear eye protection.
Yeah. And Dr. Shelby has his own line of eye protective gear that you want to give a plug? No.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I needed it. I was actually coming to the office the other day. I was laughing because they were using this hammer drill. And there were four guys. One's on a ladder. Three of them are kind of propping them up because they're installing a light onto the back of the office. And I was looking up there. Nobody had eye protection on. And the only thing I asked them was, y'all have insurance, right? And I was hoping that they would understand what I was talking about. They didn't.
They didn't.
Wear eye protection.
Well, this has been a really wonderful show. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. And there sounded like there was another caller, and we unfortunately was unable to get to him. But I do want to thank Carl from Shreveport, Randall from Shreveport, Paul from Nacogdoches, and Carolyn from Marshall for their calls. And, of course, I want to thank our guests, Dr. Chris Shelby from the Willis-Knighton Eye Institute and Dr. Scott Cavanaugh, vitreoretinal surgeon from LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport.
Thank you for having me.
For a very good show. I think it's been – you're very welcome. And I've really enjoyed it. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided by Wally Derlith, Tim Snell, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.
These eyes cry every night.